Did you watch the Winfrey interview?
I'm happy to say that I don't subscribe to a package that has Oprah's. So I wasn't going to sign up for one or two nights, and besides, I basically knew what I was going to hear.
I'm sure that online you caught some of the highlights.
I've seen some of the highlights, and you have somebody there who's struggling with, I think, telling the whole truth, and certainly is not contrite. If he's contrite, it's because he's been caught.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel validated knowing that he was finally owning up to something that he'd been so staunchly defensive about?
Well, that was his journey to take. I mean, we already knew he was guilty. I mean, he's been stripped of all his titles and banned forever from sports. I mean, that was done. The psychological process on his part to acknowledge that he's done it and to come out and say it is a trip he's got to take, and he's got to take the full trip. He's only taken part of it so far.
Is one of the examples of taking the full trip calling you and apologizing?
I'm not holding my breath for that. I think he probably thinks that I'm part of the reason that he got caught.
I'm sure he thinks that, and yet he spent a fair amount of time, several years, trying to kick you out of the IOC, trying to get you out of WADA.
Yeah.
The irony in that, I mean, I find it interesting.
Well, it was kind of the bullying attitude he had toward everyone who got in his way, and, you know, every once in a while he picked the wrong person. The IOC and WADA were certainly not going to get rid of me over, it was both Landis and Armstrong.
Landis is another one of those guys who was pushed by the wayside by Armstrong. It just seems that he left a trail of bodies in his wake.
Yeah.
Including the sport of cycling, I'd say.
It's true. And why he didn't think some of that would come back to bite him in the rear end, I don't know. I mean, maybe you're just so single-minded and self-centered that it never occurs to you that somebody would turn around and tell the truth about you.
Did he ever,
on the inside.
Did he ever threaten you with litigation?
No, the UCI did. The UCI and Verbruggen sued me in a small court in Switzerland. But again, I was then president of WADA, we defended this thing with full battle armor, and it went away.
Have you ever been threatened with litigation before from others for comments you've made that you know to be true?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's pretty standard stuff, especially if there's an American component to it. You know, that's using the courts to try and slap people down is a pretty standard U.S. tactic.
Where does cycling go from here?
Good question. I think it's a kind of a Yogi Berra thing. You know, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. They can either continue down this death spiral they're on right now, or they can use this Armstrong revelation and conviction as an opportunity to say, okay, let's stop, take stock of where we are, how bad is it really, what has become of the sport, and what can we do to change that? But I don't know that the current management is ready to do that.
Have you advocated for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
I have. I use that concept, whether, you know, it's not,
well, yeah.
It's not really a South Africa-level problem, but that sort of thing where you get people in so that they can tell the truth under oath and have some kind of an amnesty or a much-reduced penalty if they acknowledge doping themselves. I think if you don't go through that, you'll never weed out the culture that's there now.
We're seeing that in our province right now in the construction industry.
Yeah.
With the full immunity when somebody testifies. I wonder if that would work across the board in sports.
Well, you can do it. I mean, we have I'm not sure it's a full immunity. I think you can testify in Canada under the protection of the Canada Evidence Act, which does not permit what you say under those conditions to be used against you in a prosecution.
Okay.
And that sort of thing would be thinkable in terms of cycling as well.
You see, now, the thing that I find, there's a big division, and Jay and I have discussed this, between cycling, which is viewed, I mean, it's a professional sport, but it's not viewed with the same kind of luster and glamour in North America as the Big Four. Where do you think the Big Four stands as far as illegal drugs or drugs that performance-enhancing drugs?
I don't think they've made a really serious effort to deal with it. And, I mean, it was not long ago that the commissioner of the National Hockey League is saying that nothing on the WADA list would help a hockey player. Therefore, hockey players don't take any of them. Therefore, there's no point in testing them. It's just a waste of money because nobody takes any of them. I mean, it's absolutely jaw-dropping in its stupidity. And, you know, Sepp Blatter said that about soccer players, too. And National Football League has a program. But you're never really sure whether they're worried more about medical-type problems of recreational drugs than they are about performance-enhancing drugs. Certainly baseball is that way. I mean, baseball has very grudgingly been dragged into the 18th century, at least, and where it's, you know, they're now testing for steroids during the season only. And not for any of the other things that are known to be used. They're talking about, I think they've agreed to test for human growth hormone, but their lawyers, those noted scientists, the lawyers, say they're not sure whether the test is accurate or not. It's insane, and they've got away for a season and a half now of just preventing the test from being used. So there's not much of basketball is so concerned about off the court behavior that, you know, when they do their collective bargaining agreements, you know, the doping side of it, performance enhancing side of it, is the throwaway.
It's scary. I look at baseball, and which has tried to, again, you said they've been dragged into the 18th century. Ryan Braun last year, most valuable player. Of course, there was a Montreal angle to that story because it was a drug test that was supposed to be done at the WADA, the lab in Montreal. His lawyers were able to argue that it didn't get there in time and therefore could have been tampered. We had the batting title champion this year who was suspended halfway through the season. And it doesn't seem to end.
Nope.
And now we have all these guys who've retired and are Hall of Fame eligible, guys like Bonds, Sosa, McGuire.
And another accusation against Alex Rodriguez.
That's right, this in Miami, this clinic that just came out.
It doesn't stop.
Well, and the other thing, you start focusing on it's not the journeyman players that are desperately trying to get on, you know, the bench of the major league against the stars. Mm-hmm. That's a very bad message for this sport.
Well, it's a bad message to children watching it, that's for sure.
To make it to the show, you've got to do this. So the AAA, that, the AA, then it goes down to university ball, maybe even high school ball. No, the pyramid is enormous. And if you put all four pyramids together, you've got, you know, millions of potential drug users. I mean, it's a national health problem.
Does this come down to money?
Some of it. I mean, my rhetorical answer to that is, how many rich weightlifters do you know?
Right.
You know, and that's
Schwarzenegger would be the one and only.
Yeah.
But he's not even a weightlifter.
No, he's not. He's a bodybuilder.
He's right.
A bodybuilder. Yeah.
Right.
Come on, Dave. Get it right.
Sorry.
Now, I mean, the developments in bodybuilding are such that he wouldn't make it to a state final.
Right.
These days.
No. Yeah. I was going to ask, even if these four sports were to take, let's say, take this doping thing seriously, are they able to keep up? Because they seem to be coming out with these drugs, which become more and more undetectable, according to what they say.
That's always been the issue, right?
Yeah. Is this a forever battle, or can this thing possibly be won by a certain side?
Well, it's a forever battle in the sense that you're not going to change human nature.
Right.
You can influence conduct. And, you know, if you can persuade or cajole or deter 99.9% of the athletes from doing it and give them reasonable assurance that you'll catch the 0.1, then I think you've won the fight. And, you know, there's a gap. The perpetrator always has an advantage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the bank robber knows which bank, what night, and your catch-up authorities are the police. But the gap in science is a lot narrower than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
If you know what the test for and when it's likely to be taken, you can be pretty sharp on that. And you can use the indirect evidence, too.
Right.
That's how you catch the big ones like Armstrong. You know, Armstrong supposedly never failed a test.
Mm-hmm.
Or that is the myth, at least. But but people who know what was going on, so that's how they got Marion Jones. That's how they got a lot of the track and field athletes.
Mm-hmm.
I sat with so-and-so and watched him inject.
Sure.
That's as good as a positive test.
Whereas in Major League Baseball, the union is so powerful that things like that are very difficult to get admitted into evidence. For player X to say that he saw player Y, or the credibility of player X, someone like Jose Canseco saying that he injected Mark McGwire with steroids, well, consider the source.
Yeah, I mean, but you can be hanged by the same kind of testimony.
Well,
you know, it is a matter of credibility as well, but that's quite often the only way you're going to catch them.
If you guys don't mind, if you don't mind spending a couple more minutes, we do a lot of Olympics talk on our show,
mm-hmm.
and I'd love to get into that for a few minutes with
sure.
you. You were one of the architects of the Olympics becoming as big as it is in negotiating contracts with corporations and with the television stations and making the rights be as massive as they are. Do you think that maybe the Olympics have gotten too big?
No, not at all. I think it's more expensive to run an international sports system now than it ever was, and you need money. I mean, the participants can't do it. Governments have priorities in many countries that just simply don't allow for sport development. So I think that it's important that you divide the money properly, which is basically half and half between the organizers, so that the taxpayers of the host country don't pay the full shot. And the other half is the sports system, so the international sports federations to develop their programs, the National Olympic Committees to develop theirs, to send kids to places where they can get specialized training, things like that. The IOC itself to run the whole Olympic movement. I think it's a wonderful statement that the private sector can do all that. In fact, you know, when you look at it, if you didn't have the private sector, you wouldn't have organized sport.
Well, the way that sports has become, absolutely. I don't know if that's a chicken and the egg thing or not, though.
Well, I think, I mean, you know, the governments, historically, governments were not as involved in life in general as they are now. And so if it was going to happen, it happened outside the sphere of government activities. Now, as governments got bigger and bigger, sport essentially occurs within the fully regulated system. So equipment safety and standards of buildings and stuff like that are all part of the sport scene. But take away the private sector and your whole competitive sport system collapses.
I look out the corner of my eye and I can see the Olympic Stadium. And it's an example. It's not the worst example, but it's an example of something that was built for an Olympics that is severely underused and underappreciated now. There are much more modern examples. Most of the venues from the Athens Olympics I come to mind. Even the stadium in London, they haven't figured out exactly what they're going to do with it yet. A lot of that goes on to the public, doesn't it? A lot of that is, I mean, I know I think we just finished paying for that, the Olympic Stadium. In Greece, where you have so many financial issues, do you think that the state still gets involved perhaps too much and it should be shifted towards the corporate side? Or should there be better plans in place for after the Olympics? Is there not enough
ethical? I think that's the key. I mean, the Greeks have this psychological identification with the Olympics. The Olympics are theirs. But of the 28 sports that are in the Olympic program, they're only interested in half a dozen of them.
Mm-hmm.
All the rest, they don't care about. So they got into these grandiose structures without really planning for the after use. And, they got it done in the nick of time as it was, at huge cost overruns. I mean, there's a wonderful story of whether it's apocryphal or not. I don't know. In the Olympic Stadium, in about April of 2004, 4 months before the games, 5 months maybe. Somebody's there and there's a guy attaching the seats to the posts in the concrete. And so we came and looked, and there was maybe 3,000 or 4,000 of them there, and he looks, and all the rest are not there. And he said, listen, are you guys going to be ready for August 17th? No, what's up? Says, what's August 17th? It's the opening ceremonies of the Olympic Games in Athens, in this stadium. Really? He said, what time on August 17th?
Oh, amazing.
And he said, 8 o'clock at night. He said, oh, no, we'll be finished by then.
I mean, down to the minute, huh? Down to the minute, yeah.
That's great.
The Montreal Stadium is designed for track and field, and you can make it work for football. Mm-hmm. But it was an awkward baseball stadium, and that was, you know, the obligation of the city of Montreal to keep the Expos here was to have a covered stadium.
Right.
Because all these guys that would come up from their winter ball in the Dominican Republic would face April in Montreal.
And, yeah. You know,
Jerry Park was pretty tough on them.
Finally, the reason that we were able to speak with you today is because of this conference that you're a part of next week, where you'll be on a chair, I think, with Daniel Sauvageau and Ross Rebliati and a few other athletes. You'll be discussing the Canadian Olympians and how to fund them, gender issues as well. And I just was wondering if you could talk to us a bit about Own the Podium and whether you think it's working for Canada.
I think the Own the Podium has been a very good program. I mean, it takes a lot of the funding decisions on sport matters out of the political realm, puts them in the hands of people who understand the sport. So you don't have the government consideration say, well, if we give something to Vancouver, we're going to have to give something to Halifax, and we need a little support for our party in this area. And the result is you make a lot of dumb decisions. So Own the Podium was good in that sense, where the money available for high performance stuff was pooled and then decided on by knowledgeable folks. It was the hardest psychological thing was, is it a little pushy for Canada? You know, Own the Podium, isn't that a little assertive for Canada? And, which was an interesting take on it. I think it certainly showed in the Winter Games, and we had more concentrated support there that it was effective. I mean, it's too bad our alpine ski team didn't show up, but I mean,
yeah.
But for that, we've got not only the most gold medals of any country in the history of the Winter Games, but we've had probably the most medals.
Mm-hmm.
So it does work. We were a little diffuse, I think, on the summer program, and call it okay, but not superb. But I think the concept is very good.
Well, I guess my follow-up to that would be, even if we're not necessarily appearing on the podium, does that necessarily mean that Own the Podium isn't working? Or is funding necessary? Is it important without the results?
I think it's important as an idea. You know, I've always had the belief that you'll do better if you expect to do better. You're far more likely to win if you expect to win. You and everyone around you expects to win than if you say, I hope I'm going to win. And so building up that confidence, especially when you're dealing with some of these events with thousands of seconds and millimeters of distance, anything that you can use to shed the doubts that hold you back more than anything is an advantage. So getting, you know, the right diet, the right training, having somebody, if you're not naturally able to do it, tell you how to shed those doubts and how to think positive and all the things that go into an optimal sport performance is added value for sure. And we haven't always had that available in Canada.
Well, it's nice to finally see them acknowledging that it's not just about the one-star athlete from the game, but it's about the team, the collective, if you will. And I thought that was well displayed in London. It didn't matter that the only gold was in trampoline. It felt like there was a collective, that people were caring about the entire Olympic team.
Yeah, but and I think that's good. But within that particular dynamic, you've got to find some way to get to the top.
Well, Russia's only a year away.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure.